KUT and KUTX listeners, the stream you've connected to is going silent on April 20th. You're likely using an old bookmark, app, or link that's been around a long time. Please visit kut.org/streams. That's kut.org/streams for more information. If you're still hearing this message next time you listen, there's a form at the bottom of that page that you can fill in for help. Our websites, apps, and npr.org are updated, so you can tune in there. Thank you for listening and supporting our stations.
This is KUT
Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of May 2018. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Texas Democrats choose their candidate for governor.
I am constantly hearing this is going to be such an uphill battle. Please tell me when I didn't have an uphill battle.
The number of U.S. kids foregoing key services could rise under a proposed immigration policy.
Whether this is intentional or not, it has the effect of downgrading the value of citizenship of those citizen family members.
And what's the history behind the bell tower on Cesar Chavez Street?
The view is pretty spectacular. You can see all the way up Colorado Street or on the other side out to Auditorium Shores.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
I think this was a very productive conversation. 90% of the conversation consisted of listening. There are not enough people in public life that listen. Most politicians talk an awful lot and don't listen very much.
That's United States Senator Ted Cruz of Texas emerging from the third of three roundtable discussions hosted this week by the Texas governor on school safety. Governor Abbott called the meetings to get policy ideas after that school shooting at Santa Fe High School outside Houston. A 17-year-old is accused of killing 10 people and wounding 13. Cruz's comments followed a roundtable discussion around school safety that included survivors from the shootings in Santa Fe, in Sutherland Springs, and Alpine, Texas. KUT's Claire McInerney says during that roundtable, students from Santa Fe High School asked for more police presence in schools.
1 week ago, Santa Fe senior Grace Johnson heard the fire alarm, left her band room, and watched a classmate get shot in the hallway. She recounted this story to Abbott and state lawmakers, but told them her classmates had been thinking about this reality since the Parkland shooting in Florida. One of her classes wrote letters to Abbott back in February.
My entire government class wrote letters on why we think this is happening and what we can do to fix this. And we just wanted to know that you got those. Mm-hmm. Because May 18th came around and it finally happened to our school and we weren't surprised.
She and other students asked Abbott to bring more police into schools. They also requested a separate emergency alert system other than a fire alarm. Abbott told the group he is taking all of their suggestions and making an action plan. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
Texas Democrats have their nominee for governor.
And I'm gonna be that governor who will say, now let me find a path for you. Let me find a path for your health care. Let me find a path for your living wage. Let me find a path for your public education.
Lupe Valdez this week became the first openly gay and the first Latina candidate to win a major party nomination for Texas governor. She earned 53% of the vote in the runoff, according to unofficial election totals, defeating her opponent, Houston businessman Andrew White. And now Valdez has to face the incumbent Republican governor, Greg Abbott.
I am constantly hearing this is going to be such an uphill battle. Please tell me when I didn't have an uphill battle.
Valdez was the first in her family to go to college. She became the Dallas County Sheriff in 2004. She was the first woman, first Latina, and the first lesbian in that office, too. But she's right. She faces an uphill battle against Governor Abbott. And here to talk about that is KUT's Ben Philpott. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
I remember the last election for governor in 2014 in Texas. Democrats pinned their hopes on Wendy Davis, really believing that she might just win that thing, and then she wound up losing by more than 20 points. How are things looking this time around as we sit here today, months away from November?
Well, I guess we should start with maybe the negatives, which are, yes, you just said that Wendy Davis lost by 20 points. Lupe Valdez is going to start this race with, I believe, less name ID across the state, because if you remember, Wendy Davis had that gigantic national news story of filibustering in the Texas Senate to block an abortion bill. Lupe Valdez doesn't have that kind of national moment, so she's going to have less name ID, and she's going to have almost no money running up against Greg Abbott, who the incumbent governor, who will have more than $40 million in the bank. As of the last time he gave us his totals, could be $50 million by the time he finally tells us again.
You said we'd start with the negatives for Valdez, right? What are the positives? What does she have going in her favor this election cycle?
Well, she's got a popular Democrat at the top of the ticket. Representative Beto O'Rourke out of El Paso is waging a pretty strong campaign, one of the stronger campaigns that Democrats have been able to wage in Texas in a few decades, against U.S. Senator Ted Cruz for Senator Cruz's seat. He's been able to raise money. He's been able to gain attention. You know, he still is not as well known as Senator Cruz. He is still a Democrat in Texas, but polling has shown it to be a reasonably close race, or a really close race, depending on what poll you're looking at. That could really help Valdez or any of the Democrats on the ticket, because this is the last election where straight party voting is going to be on the ballot. The legislature passed a law that said, you know, let's eliminate this straight ticket voting. So if you walk into the polling booth, the very first thing you're going to see is whether or not you want to vote just all Republican or all Democrat. Right below it is, hey, Beto O'Rourke versus Ted Cruz. Now, if you're a Beto O'Rourke person, you might decide, you know what, let me just hit Democrat, and boom, all the way down the line. And that could be one of those tides that lifts all boats further down the ballot. I don't mean to sound too harsh on this to say that the positive going for Lupe Valdez is that someone else on the ballot may help her get more votes.
Right.
But considering the amount of money she starts with, the amount of money Governor Abbott starts with, the 20-point advantage that he had 4 years ago, even with this possible blue wave across the country, she needs all the help she can get.
What kind of policies will this election campaign be fought over between Greg Abbott and Lupe Valdez, do you think?
Greg Abbott's made it quite clear, in fact, before Valdez even got the nomination, that he's going to fight this on immigration. He's going to fight this on how he believes Valdez does not have the right message or beliefs on illegal immigration that Texans do, as he would say. He's already put out website. He's already put out ads saying Valdez is wrong on immigration for Texas. I think that Valdez will, you know, that could also be a point that she tries to argue, though. The whole argument with Congress and the president over DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, she can argue that this is something that, you know, a majority of Texans are okay with and support. And, you know, so therefore, let's vote in somebody who is going to help these undocumented immigrants become, at the very least, more successful members of our society, which helps, you know, everyone around.
KUT's Ben Philpott. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
There is a growing number of children who are American citizens foregoing services such as Medicaid, even food stamps, because their parents are undocumented. It's a problem that's been concerning public health experts in Texas for a while now. And as KUT's Ashley Lopez reports, there's even more concern following a proposed Trump administration immigration policy.
In a former elementary school in East Austin, Maria Hernandez is teaching a room full of slightly uncomfortable parents how to power pose.
Megan, I saw you get excited, Megan. You're like, yeah, let's do some power posing.
Some parents make a big X with their bodies, arms in the air. Others strike a Wonder Woman pose, fist to their hips. The point of this exercise is to teach these parents how to feel confident before they go into meetings where they will have to advocate for their kids. This class is put together by a group called Vela, which Hernandez says exclusively helps parents whose children have disabilities.
But we focus on the caregiver. So we offer free courses and support groups to really empower that parent to navigate the disability journey.
Vela is based in East Austin, but Hernandez says she sees parents from 55 different zip codes in the area.
Of all of those families, about 70% are immigrant families, mostly from Mexico. And so we're working with families who are the parents are immigrant, but the children are born here.
And Hernandez says families in this situation are having an especially hard time lately getting access to healthcare services for their children, who again are U.S. citizens. She works with families who have been relying on Medicaid for years because their child has a long-term disability.
And then in the last 6 months, they've already gotten requests for additional proof of eligibility. And so any of those additional requests, or we'd like you to submit extra paychecks, or just to show that you're eligible, already put parents in a place where they say, this feels scary, this feels new, and so what I'm going to do is withdraw.
And this is the exact situation that Marlene finds herself in. We're not using her last name because she's undocumented. She has two children, both are U.S. citizens. Her son has speech and learning disabilities, which is why he's on Medicaid. But for Marlene, his enrollment in Medicaid is becoming an issue for her.
Porque te están haciendo unas preguntas indagando de tu vida hasta de pies a cabeza.
She says the government is asking a lot of questions right now, investigating her life from, quote, head to toe. In fact, she says she stopped applying for her family to get food stamps because the application asked for things she never had to provide before, including years of pay stubs.
Porque me pidieron muchas, muchas cosas que no, antes no me pedían. Y para mí fue muy estresante que llegué a enfermarme de estrés y de miedo.
Marlene says foregoing food stamps is better than getting sick from stress and fear. For now, her son has another year of Medicaid, which is a big relief. But she doesn't know what will happen when she reapplies.
No sé qué va a pasar para el otro año. No sé qué me van a pedir.
And soon those services her American son is relying on could become another liability for Marlene. The Trump administration is proposing a change to the criteria for immigrants who are trying to enter the U.S. or immigrants who are already here and want to become legal permanent residents. Ann Dunkelberg is with an Austin-based think tank called the Center for Public Policy Priorities. She says that would be a big change.
Currently, the only thing that gets held against you, as it were, is if you're likely to be permanently, completely dependent on the government for your support.
She says that test of whether someone will be completely dependent on the government, which is known as a public charge, applies to people who would need to be in a hospital or nursing homes long term, among other things. But the Trump administration wants to radically change what a public charge means. They're considering adding a whole bunch of things that could count against someone immigrating here. That includes food stamps, Medicaid, food programs for new mothers, CHIP, health insurance subsidies, and even an earned income tax credit.
So not only would they potentially hold all these new things that they used to vehemently not hold against people, but they are also going to hold against the potential immigrant if any of their immediate family members use any of these benefits. And that completely includes any and all family members who are U.S. citizens and who may be using those benefits completely appropriately and legally.
And that means families will have to choose between A, getting help for their American children and possibly foregoing a legal status, and B, not getting any help at all and staying in the shadows.
Whether this is intentional or not, it has the effect of downgrading the value of citizenship of those citizen family members. So it's basically saying, well, yeah, you're a U.S. citizen, but you don't have the same rights and privileges as a U.S. citizen child.
Back in East Austin, Maria Hernandez says this could exacerbate a situation that started with Senate Bill 4. That's the law passed in Texas last year that requires local law enforcement to cooperate with federal immigration authorities.
What we're seeing the most with our families is a paralysis. So where they are coming off of SB 4, there was already such a withdrawal or a reduced access to services. And so recently, in the last 2 months, we've seen that families that have to renew Medicaid are just saying that they are not going to, out of fear, and so that they're just going to rely on emergency room visits as needed.
Hernandez says that means a lot of kids with disabilities who have made progress will likely start backsliding. And it's something parents like Marlene wish they could avoid. But she says she and other parents are withdrawing from services their children are legally entitled to for their kids.
No soy la única persona que está renunciando a cosas. No para mí, para mis hijos, que es por ley les corresponde a ellos.
This proposed policy is still under review by the White House. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
At universities across the country, student activists are talking about fossil fuel divestment. The idea is that schools should not invest money in industries that contribute to global warming. But at the University of Texas, some environmentalists are taking a different approach, as KUT's Mose Bouchel reports.
Fossil fuel divestment is a hard sell on any campus, but it's harder in Texas. That's because the UT system isn't just a collection of public universities. It's kind of like an oil company. It owns millions of acres that it leases to drilling businesses to make billions of dollars for schools. Luke Metzger leads the group Environment Texas.
If you pulled all those operations together and compared them to other oil companies around the state, UT would be the fifth largest producer of oil and gas in the state.
So what's an environmentalist like Metzger to do? He and others are pushing the universities not to divest, but to adopt more climate-friendly drilling rules. Specifically, they want UT to reduce the methane that escapes into the atmosphere from its oil field operations. Methane is a greenhouse gas many times stronger than CO2.
We think this is really a no-brainer for UT to require the companies that lease these public lands to meet the best practices to reduce this methane pollution.
It's a campaign that's been joined by students and faculty. And last week, a group of alumnus and donors sent a letter to UT Systems Chancellor Bill McRaven urging him to convene a task force on methane reduction. One of the signers was John Hoffmeister. He's the former president of the oil giant Royal Dutch Shell, but he says it should be no surprise he's in favor of this environmental effort.
Well, I'm being completely consistent with where I was during my active corporate career with what I'm doing in my post-corporate career.
In fact, he thinks it's bad for industry to resist small changes to fight global warming.
Rather than wait for the regulators to shut down the industry, why don't we shut down the emissions of the industry so that we can enjoy the fruits of those molecules?
So he supports the creation of the task force and new methane rules.
I don't believe that it is necessary.
This is Mark Hauser. He runs the office that manages UT's vast land holdings. He says industry is already doing a good job of reducing methane, though new rules aren't really his call. It's up to UT System Chancellor.
Should that be developed? Certainly we'll listen to them.
That's where things get even more interesting. UT's current chancellor, Bill McRaven, is stepping down this month. Supporters of new methane rules hope the announcement of a task force will be McRaven's swan song. If he doesn't do it, they'll likely call on his replacement too. One name that's been floated as the next chancellor, Rex Tillerson, former Secretary of State and retired head of oil giant ExxonMobil. Mose Bouchel, KUT News.
A ruling today by the Texas Supreme Court gives a victory to some homeowners who do short-term rentals but were otherwise prevented from doing so by their homeowners associations. The Texas Tribune's Emma Platoff has been covering this story. Hi, Emma.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. So what is this lawsuit, Kenneth Tarr versus the Timberwood Park Owners Association?
So, Nathan, this case really starts in 2012 when Kenneth Tarr, who you mentioned, buys a house in San Antonio. Then 2 years later, his company transfers him, but he doesn't want to sell the house. So he starts renting it using short-term rental sites like vacation rentals, those sorts of things. Shortly after he starts, he hears from his homeowners association and they say, Kenneth, you have to stop. You're violating your deed restrictions.
Okay, and what were those deed restrictions?
So Kenneth Tarr's deed restrictions, which are similar to deed restrictions that a lot of Texans have through their homeowners associations, say that his home has to be used, quote, solely for residential purposes. So that was the issue at the heart of this case. Is a short-term rental a residential purpose, or should we think about it more like a hotel, like a business purpose? And the court ruled today that we have to look at what people are doing inside the home. You know, they're eating, they're sleeping, they're watching TV, and the court ruled unanimously today that that is a residential purpose.
So in other words, in that case, even though he was using it for short-term rentals, that was determined to be a residential purpose?
Exactly.
These deeds vary widely from homeowners association to homeowners association. For those that specifically restrict short-term rentals, for example, they might say you can't rent your home for less than 30 days at a time. Would those be nullified by this ruling, or do they still stand?
Those restrictions would still stand. This ruling kind of only affects the restrictions that say something sort of vague or sort of ambiguous, like Mr. Tarr's restrictions did. They kind of define residential purposes for the first time, at least from the Texas Supreme Court.
As you write at texastribune.org, this will have no effect on, for example, the city of Austin's ordinance governing short-term rentals. But what does this say about where the Texas Supreme Court stands on the issue of short-term rentals and the pending litigation around that?
So this is a unanimous opinion, which isn't too uncommon from this court, but it's a strongly worded unanimous opinion, and it really gives a lot of attention to property rights. And property rights are at the heart of a different legal challenge, as you mentioned, to the city of Austin's ordinance on short-term rentals. So the lawyers fighting that suit are really hopeful that today's ruling kind of portends well for them in that case as well.
I think you spoke to the Texas Public Policy Foundation, the plaintiffs in that suit. What did they say?
Yes, I did. They look at this as a win, certainly. Rob Henneke, who's the top lawyer over there, said, you know, the Texas Supreme Court got it right in affirming private property rights. Another detail here is that the city of Austin's argument defending its own ordinance was largely actually based on Mr. Tarr's case from a lower court. But that ruling was overturned this morning by the Texas Supreme Court. So Mr. Henneke's argument is that, you know, they have much less of a legal basis for their argument now.
The Texas Tribune's Emma Platoff joining us to talk about her story on the Texas Supreme Court siding with short-term renters in a lawsuit that dealt with vaguely worded deed restrictions. You can read all her reporting on this at texastribune.org. Emma, thanks for your time. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Nathan.
Hearing the sound of downtown Austin. This is at the corner of Cesar Chavez and Colorado Streets, right on the banks of Lady Bird Lake. And if you've ever been there, you've probably noticed a narrow six-story tower. It's called the Buford Tower. Looks a little out of place among the new condos and high-rise constructions downtown. Someone asked about the Buford Tower for our AT Explained series. And as KUT's Audrey McGlinchey reports, the tower was built in the early 20th century for one purpose. But since then, it's lived many lives.
Any decent German fairy tale features a tower. There's Rapunzel, locked away with her long golden hair.
When she was 12 years old, the enchantress shut her into a tower, which lay in a forest and had neither stairs nor door.
In Rumpelstiltskin, a woman is banished to a tower until she can turn straw into gold.
Get to work now, spin all night, and if by morning you have not spun this straw into gold, then you will have to die.
I'm telling you all this because towers don't usually work out well for women. So, who would willingly enter one? Well, me. But I was going to be smart about it.
You want me to leave the locks here with you, or?
Yeah, that's fine. Okay. So here I was inside the Buford Tower, but I wasn't alone.
So I'm Shelly Reynolds. I'm a technical recruiter here in Austin.
Shelly's worked across the street for years, so naturally.
I was curious what the deal was with the bell tower that is right on Cesar Chavez, right overlooking Lady Bird Lake.
To answer that question, we have to go back more than a century.
In 1916, the city of Austin decided to create a professional fire department. Prior to that, as with many cities, we were serviced through volunteer fire departments.
This is Kim McKnight. She's with Austin's Parks and Recreation Department, the keeper of the Buford Tower now. She says once the city had a legit fire department, they needed a place to run drills. Enter a drill tower. Firefighters use these to practice climbing ladders, test out hoses, and in some cases, put out controlled fires. But Austin wasn't going to settle for just any drill tower. Several decades earlier, cities across the country had started buying into a beautification movement.
Anything that we're constructing should be beautiful.
So the drill tower would be designed by top-notch architects. One of them was Hugo Cuny. He had designed Austin's Ritz Theater. The ornate drill tower was finished in 1930, just to be set on fire and pounded with ladders. For example, the windows had no glass.
Open windows would facilitate the oxygen intake to make the fires really robust.
Firefighters would even put on shows for the public. A Statesman article from 1937 talks about, you know, just a regular Wednesday night event. 30 men to, quote, slide down ropes, scale ladders, lay hose, and play streams of water. If you hung around afterwards, the fire chief had promised, quote, a surprise comedy feature.
By the early 1970s, the tower had become somewhat obsolete.
Austin was rising. A six-story drill tower wasn't close enough to the real thing. In 1974, the tower closed.
And so for about 4 years, this tower is sort of sitting there. The windows are completely open, and it was really described as a six-story pigeon coop.
I wonder if any bats have ever gotten in, like, tried to make this their home.
I really hope not.
It's right next to the bat.
On the second floor of the old drill tower, question asker Shelley and I find two shoulder-high plastic consoles. From a distance, they look like old ATMs.
Oh, is this the electronic bell?
Looks like it.
In 1978, the tower was renovated. It got cleaned up. Glass was put in the windows, and electronic chimes were installed.
Oh, look, this is like the timing mechanism.
Okay.
I'm assuming.
Yeah.
It says time.
No, that looks right.
That same decade, the tower also got its name.
Hi, my name is Karen Buford McCoy, and my dad was Jim Buford.
I'm Gail Klosterhoff, and I'm Karen's sister.
In 1972, Gail and Karen's dad, James Buford, was a captain with the Austin Fire Department. One afternoon in June...
Well, I think it was a Friday... And it was raining really, really hard.
Buford got called out to Shoal Creek in northwest Austin.
There was a teenage boy on a motorcycle. There were two of them, but only one died, right?
According to news reports from the time, two high school boys had been riding out to swim. They turned a corner and ran into floodwaters. One of the boys got swept away. Buford got to the scene.
He tied a rope around his waist.
Then he had to secure it to something.
He was headed toward the telephone pole to tie off so he wouldn't be swept away. And ultimately, that's what happened.
Buford was carried downstream.
We were told he went through a big culvert, a concrete culvert on the side of the road, and they found him downstream.
Buford was taken to Breckenridge Hospital, where he died the next day. 2 years after his death, the same year the drill tower was decommissioned, city council members named it after him, Buford Tower.
Nice view of, like, seeing down the lake, traffic, people coming into work.
Yeah, the windows are pretty dirty.
The inside of the tower isn't as nice as the outside. Each floor is a concrete slab. The windows could use a good scrub. Old holiday lights are strung throughout.
Is this floor 5?
Over at the top.
Oh, these are just stairs that lead nowhere. It's fairly anticlimactic, but...
But then, we spot a trap door.
Oh, you can open it! Can we go up? Whoa!
There are indeed birds. They're nesting on the edges of the sixth floor. The floor itself is covered in twigs and bird poop. The windows are nothing but grates to let the sound of the chimes out. In the middle, there are 8 speakers.
They just look like big bullhorns.
Yeah, like what cheerleaders use? What are those called?
Megaphones. The view is pretty spectacular. You can see all the way up Colorado Street or on the other side out to Auditorium Shores.
This is so cool.
This tower has been many things. Firefighter training ground, timekeeper, beautiful landmark.
I've taken my children there. I just tell them the story of their grandfather.
Gail Klosterhoff was 16 when her dad died.
Sometimes I'll see someone, catch a glimpse of someone that I think resembled what he looked like at that time. You know, he wasn't there to walk me down the aisle. He wasn't there at the birth of my children. You always miss your parent. You never really get over it.
For some people, Buford Tower is a memorial to their dad. Audrey McGlynn Shee, KUT News.
That is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of May 2018. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org, or you can ask me on Twitter. I am @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. ¶¶